This is the first of the usual evening forums will be held. Sometimes they take the form of a film. There will always be something at 9 o'clock. And it is, of course, posted. My name is Paul Menzel. I have the very lucky title of village philosopher, which is definitely the most delightful title I've ever had in my life, much better than professor of anything. And I teach at Pacific Lutheran University. Our topic this evening is one of two programs on the general topic of religion and health. In particular, it's care of the dying and the concept of hospice. There are three other people who will make some introductory comments. We'll try to keep those to 15 to 20 minutes and then open up very quickly to your comments and questions. On my far right is Ruth Mance, who is volunteer coordinator of the Methodist Hospital in Minneapolis. She has been involved in the planning of that hospice and the coordination of volunteers since its inception. It is both an in and an outpatient hospice. I guess one might also call it an outgoing patient hospice. It tries to place some of the hospital patients in homes. Next on my right is Maren Schmidt, who has, for 2 years, been the nurse and coordinator of the Metropolitan Medical Center's hospice in Minneapolis. However, Ruth and Maren have not coordinated notes over the years, so this isn't a loaded presentation from one point of view. They did not know each other until this week, although they're from Minneapolis. She is now in, has spent a year at Holden in the recent past, and is now in graduate work. On my left is Karen Granberg Michelson, who's a board member of the new hospice in Missoula, Montana, and comes to this particular work, involvement in hospice, from the perspective of someone who's worked a lot in whole person healthcare. Maren has some introductory comments on her conception of hospice. You may not be familiar with the term. I've been using it already, but she will explicitly explain what it's all about, and then we'll get into some of the other issues.
I'd like to preface my remarks by just saying that I'm so pleased, and we're also pleased this evening, to just have the opportunity to share together about what I think is one of the most exciting changes in healthcare delivery today, and one of the most exciting lifestyle changes that is now coming to the United States. And that's how I sort of look at the concept of hospice as becoming, and it's very exciting to share with this here at Holden. I will explain briefly what hospice is, the basic characteristics and components, but before that, I'm kind of curious as to how many of you have heard of hospice. Good, quite a few at least have heard. How many may have had a personal experience in a hospice or with a hospice? Several, good. I did some brief seminars just a year ago, and certainly this is more out of an audience than we had last year, so I can see that the term is spreading, and that's exciting to see. Good. Just to make sure that we're all on the same level then in terms of definition and understanding, I'll go over the 8 basic characteristics that we look at about hospice. Basically, hospice is a concept of care for patients and for the patient's family. And it's a concept that emphasizes care versus cure. So it is an alternative to the traditional biomedical system. It emphasizes quality of life rather than merely the prolongation of a mechanical existence. The philosophy centers around the idea that we must treat the person rather than just the disease. that a person is more than his disease. A person is a spiritual, social, emotional, physical being. Inherent also in that philosophy is that death is a normal part of life. Also, the awareness of one's own impending death or the reaction to a death in your family may very well bring some emotional illness on your part or on the part of the family. That in general, death and dying in our present day society tend to lead to fragmentation and alienation or isolation of patients and their families. Fourth, that formal training of physicians to date is lacking in terms of putting dying patients and their families in a whole perspective, so that still yet they are at a considerable disadvantage and remain often isolated at this stage of life. The care of and treatment of chronic pain, also seen in terminal illness, is still not yet in biomedicine as well managed as it could be, and hospice is also directing this inherent in its philosophy. And finally, that excellent patient care for the terminally ill need not be more expensive than present-day acute medical care. The eight basic characteristics, then, are initially that the patient and family are the unit of care. We emphasize this because we don't want to isolate the patient from their family. They are a total being, and the family experiences everything, this change, right along with a person in the end stage of their life. Secondly, the emphasis is on symptom control, and most importantly, pain control initially. In any hospice program, we like to say that we can control chronic pain within 48 to 72 hours. And that is really an initial symptom that must be attended to before we can really get at the other symptoms that the patient and family may be experiencing. Their spiritual hurts, their emotional hurts. We need to control that pain, and it can be done through what we call a hospice mix. It's a morphine kind of cocktail, and can be adjusted individually so that chronic pain can be effectively controlled. Thirdly, that the services are physician-directed. This is absolutely mandatory because often when a person is at the end stage of their life, the greatest fear that they have is the fear of dying alone. And because a physician has been with them along the road, they feel often abandoned if the physician takes a lesser role in their care. So this is important to keep at the forefront, that services are physician-directed. Fourthly, an interdisciplinary team is a unique component of hospice. The fact that physicians, nurses, social workers, and such other disciplines as music therapy, dietitians are all brought in to hospice to work directly with the patient and family together on an equal basis. Fifth, bereavement. This involves that care does not stop with the death of the person, but extends beyond that period for a year to work with the family to make sure that there is no, that the adjustment to the loss is done in a productive way so that the person can again assimilate into society and that they aren't lost. After the death of a significant other, the toll in terms of public health is tremendous in terms of suicide and situation of that nature. So this is a very important component to health promotion in a way. Next, that care is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This gives a tremendous security to the patients and families that they can call and at any time get someone to be with them and answer their questions. Provides tremendous security. Next, that volunteers are an integral part of the healthcare team. This is also a unique component in that we do train people that are a part of the community to be an equal component in this kind of care. Patients and families can often relate to a volunteer much better than they can to a professional. A volunteer comes to them from a caring component and as a friend. And often when they can't share with a professional, what they can't share with a professional, they can share with a volunteer. And lastly, that the service is a coordinated home care and inpatient effort. Home care is a very important alternative to families who would like to maintain the wholeness, and to patients who would like to remain at home for as long as possible. What we mean by coordinated effort, then, is that the staff that cares for them in the hospital knows what's going on at home. The staff that cares for them at home knows what's going on when they need to enter the hospital. So the communication gap is not there. It's a total care and coordination of that kind of effort. So basically, these are the eight characteristics that make hospice unique and make it an alternative to traditional ways of caring for a person in the end stage. Hospice concept is not new, and Ruth would like to explain a little bit to you about the history of it.
Hospice is really a word that was well known in the Middle Ages, and at that time it was a way station for pilgrims and travelers who were on their journeys, often journeys that extended for a very, very long time, and journeys on which people of all ages were a part, so that at a hospice, which was very often a place that was a convent or a monastery, people if they were ill, it was conceivable that they might die there. It was also possible that babies could have been born at a hospice. So at a hospice, people came for renewal and for refreshment and for support on their journey. And in every real sense, that is exactly what hospice hopes to do today. It hopes to give people support and to give them refreshment and to renew them on the last stages of their pilgrimage through life. Hospice is really what families have done through all the ages in the caring for their own, in the caring for the dying. As late as the 19th century, it was very common for people to die at home, and people were not shielded from death, so death was a more common and much more talked about experience than it has been until very recently in American society, when people like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and others have again made the notion of death a very real one, and one that is an end part, a natural part, however unnatural we may think of death, an ending at least of our life. When the alternative of hospitalization came about, the ill and the dying were removed from their familiar surroundings and from the care of their family to a much more antiseptic hospital environment, and there people would go to visit them. And if you've ever been in a hospital, you know it's quite a different feeling to have someone come to visit you than it is to be at home and to be cared for by those that you love and to be around the natural hubbub and excitement of a family life. Hospice, as we know it today, originated in England, and about already in the 1940s it was well established, and it started in two places, one called St. Joseph's Hospice in London and the other St. Christopher's Hospice. In London, the hospice is actually a place, it is a building, it is apart from the hospital, and it is its own self-contained unit where people who are in the terminal stages come for care. It is in these hospices that they receive the comfort of their family, because family is invited to stay there with them, and many of the familiar things from home are brought there too. Cecil Saunders is the one who is the director of the St. Christopher's Hospice in London, and it is he who has developed a hospice that has become a model and a program after which most hospices model themselves. When hospice came to America, it changed, and it is as varied as the needs of the community. And today, there are more than 300 such programs around the United States, and probably even many more. Maren, correct me if I'm incorrect, because it's a concept that is growing so quickly, it is really mushrooming, all of which proves to those of us who are involved in hospice that it is really a much needed and a much wanted thing. The premise of hospice, as Maureen mentioned, is this, that the patient and his family has the right to stay in control and to decide where one should die. It has been discovered, too, that families have less difficulty in adjusting to the loss of a loved one if they have kept the loved one, if they've kept in close contact with the loved one. That doesn't mean that everyone has to die at home. It simply means that people are given the choice. And it means that sometimes people will come home for a period of time and then again return to the hospital if that need should arise. Karen Amarin mentioned that every successful hospice depends heavily on volunteers. It has been estimated that only 10% of the care of the terminally ill at this point in their life is medical, and that leaves 90% for the other things that Maureen mentioned, the psychological, the cultural, the religious, the financial, the many other things that you might want to name. Volunteers are very carefully screened, and they're carefully trained, and they are the liaisons between the patient and the family and the multidisciplinary team that Karen mentioned, the social worker, the chaplain, the nurse, the doctor, of course, the dietitian, the therapists. What are the duties of a volunteer? A volunteer is a friend to the family, and a volunteer will do really just what the family wants. It can be something as simple as helping in the shopping, or providing transportation, or some light housework, or just to relieve the primary caregiver so he can go up and take a nap or go away to run some errands. There is a myth that volunteers work without compensation, and that is not true. But the payment for volunteers is very unique. It is given in a unique kind of currency, one that is never subject to inflation, one that cannot be destroyed. It is something that is we call the currency of the heart, because what volunteers do, they do for compassion, for the sake of the compassion they feel, for the empathy they feel for another human being, for a brother or a sister who is ending his journey on life. Hospices in no way try to tell you what is the correct way to die, but it does offer an alternative way of dying.
Karen?
I think my angle is a little different. I'm not a practitioner in hospice, neither in training volunteers nor on the medical staff, but about 4 years ago I was a chaplain intern at the Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C. My responsibility was with critically ill and dying children and their families. This obviously was where the rubber met the road as far as my offering support to families and children who were dying, particularly of cancer. One death of one child and the family feeling about that is particularly memorable. There were no alternatives. It was a hospital, very poor family, and a pretty straight hospital death where the doctor wrote on the chart, this person has renal failure among other things and is expected to die within a matter of hours. And so the doctor, of course, didn't bother really to make any further calls on this little girl. Contrast to that, in Missoula, I've been lucky to help support a new hospice, which is strictly outpatient, although obviously they work with a community hospital. And I've seen children have the support of dying at home by their own choice with their families. And so I guess I would just close by saying I see hospice as a real branch of a whole person approach to medicine, very parallel to alternative styles of birthing. So that's my angle.
John Schramm has a word or two that he would like to add about an involvement of Holden and that relates
yes,
to this.
Larry mentioned that Holden's corporation is exploring having a hospice or a hold and starting a hospice. I'm not sure that's a good technical term, but let me tell you what we are exploring, and it comes the closest to the Middle Ages concept of hospice than anything else that's been said so far. Holden for over a decade has said maybe there ought to be a Holden farm. Some of the Holden volunteers are growing some of the food for the village or having a product, but that never was a high priority because I think unless there were some other components to that, it's not really either necessary or the amount of effort probably would not appeal to the corporation. Several components, including Marin's sessions last summer, and Leo Busted, who's active in Holden work and has been for years, doing pet and animal therapy and sneaking cats into nursing homes and driving medical officers, the county medical health boards are crazy, but the patients love it and get better. Even goldfish help. Has meant that there are some components that interested the board enough that we are spending a year in developing a proposal. The term I use is Holden is interested in starting an inclusive community, more inclusive than here, partly because the remoteness of this does not let us be as inclusive. We even were unable to tell Paul Bergman, he died last year and was one of the pioneers, lived at Stehekin, and probably would have come here had he known he could come here to die. The lack of transportation out of here, the three boats a week in the winter, means we do not have some of the things necessary for that. So inclusive community, including a group of people who live with some at least monastic hours or some aspects of a worship life together, who have guests, retreats over the weekend maybe, but also some guests who stay longer and some guests who stay and die there, that would be included in the planning for how inclusive it would be, even down to everybody kind of adds ideas whenever we start to talk. And it is brand new. It just came this June as a priority. Someone suggested gardens with paths wide enough for the wheelchairs to go through so that people can weed the garden even if they're now in a wheelchair. Including alternative funeral practices, including making the pine box in the carpentry shop of the community and digging the grave, which is still done in West Virginia, and I thought was a good practice. We all dug the grave and then went to the house for a dinner afterwards, potluck, kind of the support of the community. So an inclusive community, having a product, raising some food, having some animals, and included in the assumption of guests, some long-term guests, including terminally ill, for whom that would be the place where they die. And by next summer, Joel Oinas and I and a few others are to bring a proposal for the corporation to act upon. It was made the first priority to explore for this year. So that's where it is.
Let me just mention very briefly two concerns that have cropped up in the last 5 years in the rather extensive literature about death and dying over both hospices and the wider problems of death and dying. They've been capsulized perhaps best by a theologian, Paul Ramsey, in an article entitled The Indignity of Death with Dignity. He was trying to state very concisely some what he thought were moral dangers in the whole movement of care rather than cure at the terminal stage. First of all, he said that there was an emphasis on quality of life which set dangerous precedents for other areas of medical care, where again quality of life rather than life itself might be taken as the decision standard. Apply that to defective newborns, for example. He also saw the danger of subtle coercion, where society gets people to expect that when their life in some ways seems not to be worth living, and when especially it is economically burdensome or burdensome on other people in other ways, that they will be expected to accept death. And he saw a great danger in that. I don't want to plug those dangers, I just want to mention that those are some of the important reservations that some very thoughtful people have had about some of the issues related to this, not to hospice in particular. What are your concerns?
I wonder if the panelists would react to this caution that you just expressed.
I guess I would have a comment about that, because certainly that is a very real danger. Just before we left to come here for Holden, there was a gentleman at the hospital who had a brain tumor and who was just so overwhelmed with his feeling of just a loss of any sense of worth and value and any sense of pain that he spoke of suicide. And I know that that is one area that a person has to be aware of in this whole process. It is something that I think that I would want to include in our next training session for the volunteer to have for the volunteers to have some sort of suicide prevention study included in it.
There's a very fine line between
very fine
supporting
line.
People in dying on the one hand and encouraging dying on the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
What?
It's just so highly individual to each person has to die in their own way and in their own time. And I think in relation to coercion that I don't know, I was really pleased that Paul raised that issue. It is evident, I think, and our families have struggled with it too, intimately. I don't know an answer. It is an issue.
It's a real danger,
danger.
You saw in your work.
Right.
How would that danger come up? Was it something that you were just imagining, or the staff was imagining, or how concrete? Danger. The Ramsey's critics hit him by saying, oh, this is just imagined danger.
Hmm. Okay. At the moment, I've been removed from our examples for about a year now. Let me think about that for a few minutes, and maybe some others in a few could respond to that element.
If I could comment, I think that there's no question that death and dying has gone pop, just like holistic health. It has become cool to take out books on death and dying and to, you know, get very remote and removed about it, you know, as if this is something that one could ultimately control and take the fear out of it by being on top of it, you know, build one's own casket and put the design on it. I mean, it can get really cavalier. But I think that ultimately there's a shakedown, and that it's too serious a matter for people for it to stay that way. I think there will be a leveling effect, and that the people that choose to die at home will do so with much thought and much, you know, much choice.
Dying is very hard work, and it's heavy. It takes a lot of strength for those who are supporting the person who is dying, and I think that is why it is so important to have people there who will support them, and I mean not only just physical support and emotional support, but spiritual support. I think, too, that we learn so much when we are involved with people who are in this stage of their lives. We learn a lot about living from the way people die.
Yes?
I think I sometimes sense that some people actually feel that they should be dying because of a doctor and the family and the expense before they can make it. You know, I think of one, it's almost a humorous illustration, but kind of illustrates this, because I think the patient actually heard the doctor, you know, say, you know, well, she'll be dead in 4 hours. And all the stuff that kind of goes on around that time, And finally, she said to me, because we had a confidence, she says, Pastor, she says, I know I'm supposed to die at night, but she says, I've been a stubborn Norwegian all my life, and I won't make it. And we went back the next day, and we had a little coffee together, and then he went down there, and she had just waited for him, said a couple of very significant words, laid back, and then she was able to die. But she couldn't make it the night before, and she felt a little guilty about it, but she could find it.
Good illustration. Yeah.
Wes?
In listening to Ruth's description, which was very fascinating, is it right, Ruth, that hospitals also evolved out of what we call hospices historically?
I wish I could answer that. I can tell you this, that I've been in several of the very, very old hospitals in Europe, and I'm thinking of one in the city of Beaune in France. And it was a large room like this, lined with beds. And sometimes when there was a lot of illness, the plague, there were two or three, as many people as they could fit into a bed. And so if there were people in the same bed, right next to you might be dying. I'm thinking of another hospital in the city of Bruges, which was in the undercroft of a building. And that too was a room like this, with none of this of the privacy or the sterility of a modern hospital. I really don't know. I wish someone could tell me what the history of the hospital is. Do you know?
That was my impression that, like hospices, they were begun by the church.
I would think that would be illogical.
And that it became then secularized as events in history unfolded, which raises to me the question, and particularly when looking at the kinds of things that also Marna talked about, why shouldn't a church have its own hospice? I mean, what more, why should the church get involved after it's all done and have a funeral? When you think about it, if the whole point is having this sort of support group and the kind of care that goes deeper than just the medical, instead of even having hospice outside of the church body, if the experience of dying is to be somewhere else than the hospital, shouldn't it be within the church?
You know, the Jewish people have shown us a good way in that. And in Minneapolis, there is a congregation in which they build the pine coffin, they make the shroud, and when death is imminent, a part of the community is there to support, to do the hospice sort of thing, and they stay with the family and sustain them through this. I think we learn from that.
I think initially, too, it really was with the church in terms, and certainly the same root word, hospital, hospice. It comes from, I believe, a Latin word, hospicase, which means place of rest for the weary traveler. And initially, the first sort of hospices were started and run by nuns. Mm-hmm. So it's, very much, it's just kind of coming full cycle again to coming back to the church. It would be grand if the church would really pick this up.
I think hospice would be a natural for the church. I think that hospital developed as technology developed. Mm-hmm. And there were all these tubes and machines that you just couldn't manage in the home.
Nyla?
I wonder if one of the most supportive things about hospice is that families who have someone dying, have someone with them, whether it's a volunteer or someone else or a professional person who has been around a dying person before. I think that maybe is one of the most frightening things to be with somebody who's dying and have never been with someone before who's dying. I know, of course, in my experience, it's the working with children and with parents, and many of them have said, have you ever been with a child who's dying before? How long does it take? What will happen? And just to go through all of these things so that people are prepared for that kind of thing and not have to be surprised or wonder what's going to happen. And I think that hospice
John?
I was going to say a similar thing, and I'm still getting back to Paul Ramsey. I think it's good to raise possible going too far. I don't know if that's the best way to say it, but I think we're still far from that. I mean, it's okay as a warning, but we're still so far the other way that we can't talk about it, really, that in a hospital, a death is a defeat.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't say you hide it, but you really, the person cannot freely talk about it. It's kind of hush-hush because everybody assumes this will not happen, and that simply is not part of life, death, and the cycle of it. That Steve May, who drives the ambulance in Wenatchee, he and John Gill from the emergency room were up, and they started talking about this. Didn't know Holden had been considering this at all. They said they enjoyed the community life here, and John Gill said the one thing I missed was that it doesn't include any really old people, or the people who are here don't ever experience the full cycle, including death or the care of someone who's ill. And Steve commented on how often the person dies in the ambulance. The people call and just kind of get the person out of the house when death. Well, that's tragic. That, I mean, they don't even get to the hospital yet, but they don't want it to happen there in the home, like with the family gathered around. And I think of the alternative to that, one of the persons who used to love Holden, Carl Ufer, was on the staff of the district. And when Phyllis and Sharon, his daughter, wife, his widow and daughter, wrote, they commented on how much they had appreciated being at Holden, because every day they went through the services of Matins and Compline, and they had just finished Vespers when he died. Well, how different from this kind of not wanting it to happen with the family around. And I still would like to have a little more of that before I worry about it going too far. So, and that's one thing that hospice means to me, is you don't have to repress it or deny it or afraid the kids experience the death of a grandpa that lives in the home with them.
Ramsey was very clear he didn't want people to repress or deny that.
Yeah.
The question is, once you don't repress or deny it, how do you view it?
Yeah.
And what attitude do you take toward it?
Mm-hmm. He was speaking about how a person would die in an ambulance or not wanting to have the death at home. My father died at home just a month ago, and we had an awful lot of pressure not to have him there. When we were concerned about wanting some information, we'd call the doctor, and they'd say, "Well, bring him in," and you can't pack him up and take him in. Just the medical facility to the home or the delivery to the home was really a problem, and that's where he wanted to be. His fear was to die, as he saw a lot of his friends in by himself in a nursing home or with nobody around that he knew. And it was very hard for us to keep him there, and we felt almost a pressure that it was that we weren't doing the right thing, per se. From some people, not from...
From health care?
Well, we finally found some visiting nurses that really helped, but we didn't know of that for a while. And then that became a different situation.
Did you find it a good experience? Did you find it was a chance for you to exchange conversations?
We had different family members come for a period of a week and from California or from Eastern Washington. And my mom is the same age. They were in the late 70s, so she needed help. And it wasn't a new experience to her at all. Her dad had died at home, and they were farming people from Montana, and they wouldn't have any place to take them anyway. But yes, there was a lot of people coming and leaving, which was nice because the people came when the person was alive, rather than all these people coming and saying, "Gee, I wished I'd known this was going on, or I wished I'd said this or something." So that was nice.
Difficult to do it on your own, though. I'm glad you found the nurses or some other supporting people, because it does, you know, get very heavy, just the physical kinds of care that go on, I'm sure. So.
Our church had a medical, you know, this is something you go home to your church and find out. They had a hospital bed, that we got to take and put up in an area of the house off of the kitchen. And there were just pieces of things that you don't have and that are very expensive to go to rent or something like that. Go home and buy your church a hospital bed. One of the bathrooms that you can carry around.
Yes?
Is the trend toward having separate facilities or in a hospital or what?
We see hospice, again, is a concept, and I see it taking many, many forms throughout the United States. As I talked to Cheryl, that knows in Tucson they have what's called a freestanding hospice, or had a freestanding hospice, which is a building or a place all of its own. Many are taking an old home and using that in a hospice. Lots of hospitals are redoing units within the hospital to make it more like home. They bring in plants, have afghans as quilts, all those kinds of things. And then other hospices are strictly home care hospice. The second hospice in the United States, Hospice of Marin in California, is strictly a home care hospice where all the service is just directed in the home and they don't have any sort of alternate inpatient facility per se. So it's taking a lot of different forms.
In our hospital in Minneapolis, and I can speak more freely of that situation, if a patient does come into the hospital after having been at home for a while, that is a very viable option. And then every care is taken to leave it as home-like as possible, so there are no visiting hours. And if the patient would like some special kind of food, no restrictions on that. If there's a special pet, the cat that you mentioned, John, we've had dogs brought into the hospital, you know, that's fine. Rocking chairs, because what is more instinctive than a rocking sort of a feeling? Just anything to make it as comfortable and as possible for the patient and the family.
Another term you will hear sometimes, it's not nearly as common, of course, is palliative care ward, and that would be in a hospital. Very similar thing. Palliative care ward. The major, I can't remember the name of the hospital in Montreal, calls theirs that. Larry?
Modern invention of the costs of care do not or aren't not and have, but they will not exceed the cost of acute care. And I was wondering if you just said a few things about why that would be the case. I mean, is it because of volunteers? Is it because of cost? Is it because it focuses on symptoms and you're sort of past the stage of
acute technology?
Of the high cost of acute care? Or what makes it possible to keep those down relatively speaking?
Mm-hmm. I think primarily the emphasis on home care, Larry, has enabled that to be so. If a person can be maintained at home, if a family feels confident in that care at home and through the use of volunteers, the cost is able to be kept down. Hospital stays are very expensive, and yet bringing a physician to the home or a nurse to the home is able to be competitive with the hospital stay in terms of cost. That's still being documented. That's really very new in terms of being able to say that we are cost effective or more efficient than a hospital stay. So that still is really being documented. But it is because of being able to educate the families to be confident enough to carry about good care, quality care in the home, that we are able to compete cost-wise.
Wes?
Well, on that line, one of the major inhibiting factors to alternative medical care is that the medical industry and insurance industry doesn't fund it.
Yes.
Now, what's the situation with hospice?
Much progress being made. Mm-hmm. Blue Cross and Blue Shield has been in with many of the negotiating teams and on the formative efforts and are just experimenting with providing reimbursement. And I think, Ruth, maybe you know some specifics too, but in Connecticut, the Connecticut Blue Cross Blue Shield fully funds hospice care now, and so it's gradually happening. And that's exciting. That's going to be the key, really, is getting the third party payment reimbursement for that.
Yes?
No, mine was about insurance.
Some insurance companies do leave room for a full-time nurse or for 8 hours of nursing care, and that's very, very important, because we've had cases where members of the family needed to work, where their husband had to go to work and didn't want to leave, in this case, the wife alone for that period of time, but they could break it up so that the nurse would be there during the time that someone was away. And that was completely covered by insurance. That is not always the case, and sometimes could be very costly.
John?
I just wondered if there was any Medicare coverage. That'll be the big breakthrough for people for whom that's their medical insurance. Is there any way that Medicare will pick up hospice instead of in the hospital?
I'm not aware that it's doing it at this point. I think there have been some changes in terms of, as Ruth alluded to, in terms of the length that a nurse is able to be in the home, that would be covered. But
by Medicare?
Yeah. In terms of the number of hours.
That was the bind in our family last fall with my dad. Johns Hopkins for 6 days was $4,700, mm-hmm. and ours was $180. Mm-hmm. Medicare paid the rest. Would not pay for any care in the home. Mm-hmm. We were really financially better off when he was in Johns Hopkins than any other method of having. So, I mean, we spent our vacation and spent 5 weeks doing it, but we couldn't arrange for visiting nurse or anything else on their budget when he wasn't technically admitted full-time to the hospital. Then we were in good shape again. It was really just kind of backwards.
Yeah.
Hospitalization runs out, but at the hospital that I'm at, then they are then moved into the extended care facilities,
uh-huh.
which seems to have which is less care and a longer term. But that is a real problem,
yeah,
John.
It is.
It almost penalizes you when you wish to do it.
When I play the devil's advocate and just put in a word for the insurance company at this point, or Medicare, I tend to agree that it seems to be a stupid policy in terms of costs. But anytime you expand a service, you have to look at the possible abuses of expanding it too, and where do you draw the line on what's legitimate home care? That is a more difficult line than the line between being in a hospital and not being in a hospital. It's just a difficult line drawing problem. And until they feel confident that they got a way to draw that line, they're not going to step out into paying for home care. They have stepped out, of course, into paying for nursing care. And so I'm sure some hospices qualify under those Medicare provisions.
I think I would challenge that, because I think insurance companies exist for themselves and to be institutions and not for people. I don't see them as primarily concerned about humans, and I think we see this in the birthing thing. If you want to do a home birth, you're on your own in most cases money-wise. If you go to the hospital, you're covered, just as in the case of John's father. So I would take an antagonistic posture toward insurance companies.
Well, home care for the elderly, for example, or for the dying. How do you define what is dying? How early can you say that starts?
But it boils down to a lot of integrity, which I don't think insurance companies are really qualified to measure. I mean, how many people are going to lie or fudge on when somebody in their family?
It's not a question of anybody lying or fudging. It's a question of just the difficulty of knowing where the line is.
Okay, perhaps
we don't even know theoretically how to draw the line.
Perhaps I'm not clear what you're saying.
Well, it's very difficult to say when dying starts. It's very difficult to say when home care is needed as distinct from just being in a home when one is starting to die.
I think this is putting the burden of responsibility on the medical doctor. If the doctor says go to the hospital.
Yeah, but one of the reasons.
If the doctor says go home, the doctor is saying you're well, and that releases the insurance company.
But insurance companies don't trust doctors to say, well, you really do need a nurse in home care either. Doctors have been at the head of a healthcare system which has seen costs escalate tremendously.
But it's hard to believe that the costs at home would be anywhere near what the cost would be in the hospital from a practical standpoint when you really think about it. Even if you offer counseling services or nursing services in the home, when you think about $2.50 per aspirin in the hospital. The charge for daily room fees and physicians consulting fees and all the rest of the services are part of the hospital. I just can't imagine that it could be more expensive at home than in the hospital.
If three times as many people use it for 10 times the amount of time, it could be. I'm not saying that that's a definitive. I tend to agree with you. I've already been expressed. But.
I'd like to hear from a couple of the people that have had personal experiences with hospice, maybe sort of in relation to Nyla's comment earlier, in terms of the supportive service, and you know, did that help with the loneliness, with understanding what death would be like, with helping to, you know, in any way. I'd like to hear from.
May I share an experience then that I just had a few days ago here at Holden? 2 years ago when Jane Van Dusen was here as a nurse in the same role, Mom, as you were last year, we did a small little session on care of the terminally ill and on hospice. And we were explaining, as I look back now, perhaps in rather glowing terms on really how much the supporters, how much strength they can get really from the person who is dying, and how dying can be a growing experience for those who are involved in the care. And one young man got up and was really very upset, and he said, you know, it isn't all that easy, it isn't all that beautiful, it's hard, and it's painful. And he said, my father is ill just now, and I have lost my father before his death. He's no longer the strong figure that he was. And we sensed from this man a great deal of anger, and we tried to speak to him about this. And after a while, he followed us outside, and we continued our discussion. And I know I had a lot of unresolved feelings about his comments, and I felt really that we hadn't answered what he was really saying. I was walking down the path here at Holden 2 or 3 days ago, and someone called me Ruth, and I turned around, and here it was, this young man. And I said, tell me, have your problems solved themselves? And he said, well, his father hadn't had cancer, but he had a kidney ailment which necessitated being on dialysis. And he said, my father is still living. And he was supposed to have a kidney transplant, but because of an infection, he's had to forego it. But I'm feeling very good about it. And he said, I want to tell you, I've often regretted the way I spoke that night, because I felt that I interrupted a gracious presentation. And I said, John, may we tell you how badly we felt, because we heard your anger, and we should have told you, it's all right to be angry. It's all right to say, this isn't the way I want to see my father. This isn't what I want to see happening. And I think so often we believe that there are certain routes that we follow along the way to dying, denial, anger, acceptance, the whole bit, and nothing follows in that kind of a neat pattern. And very often, one day a person can be very angry, and the next day a person can be accepting and understanding, and another day one can deny it. And you can go back and forth in a very zigzag, in a switchback way, if you will, on this until you finally accomplish what you must in that resolution. So I was just wondering if any of you, it's too late now, the bell rang, I was really hoping some of you would maybe speak of other feelings about that.